Next month, we're planning a panel discussion with four campus faculty members entitled A Mirror of Adventism. This is a roundtable discussion of the recently republished revised book, Seeking a Sanctuary, Bolin Lockhart's Historical Sociological Study of Adventism. Some of you may know the recent National Adventist Forums Conference was actually built around themes growing out of this book, and they were fortunate enough to have the two authors there to participate. So we think that will be a fun, stimulating time. Pamela Harris, Gary Land, Dwayne McBride, and Russell Staples have all agreed to participate and make little presentations and help with the discussion. So we invite you to join us next month. It's February 23. And you probably noticed there are sign-up sheets in the back. If some of you aren't getting email notifications of the forum events and would like to, why, just leave us with your information there. I'd like to begin today's discussion with sharing a few words which appear as an epigraph in a famous book on nature that was published back first in 1859. Let no man think or maintain that a man can search too far or be too well studied in the book of God's Word or in the book of God's works, divinity or philosophy, but rather let men endeavor an endless progress of proficiency in both. I think our speaker today is someone who tries to sort of carry out that ideal, who is very concerned with increasing our understanding both of God's, if you want to say, written word and God's book of nature. Dr. Goodwin is a paleontologist by training. He's on the faculty here at Andrews, teaches paleobiology. He graduated from Southern Adventist University, so obviously everything he says will be duly orthodox and acceptable. He did go on to get a PhD at the University of Kansas, and he did teach for a few years at Loma Linda, so you know, you may want to be just a little careful. But he's been here at Andrews for a number of years, and he is very interested, obviously, in fossils. He studied fossils both locally and far away. You saw the picture up there on the screen of him with a pet whale fossil down in Peru. You may have seen a while back a story in the South Bend Tribune about him accepting a set of mammoth bones that were discovered out here in Eau Claire on the Prillwitz farm, which brings me to mention he is curator of the Natural History Museum here on campus. Tom pointed out in the little blurb that he gave us that was in our announcements that Adventist scholars have been studying some of these perplexing issues for 50 years or more and found some solutions, but have also found some very persistent problems that don't seem to want to go away. And Tom's hope is that we can use this not as a basis for division, but as a basis for some creative progress forward where we can work together rather than at odds. So we're all looking forward to what you have to say, Tom, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you all for coming out on a very wintry Michigan day. I'm not sure whether to thank Art or crucify him for asking me to come for this presentation, but we'll see. Hopefully, my effort will be to be honest, but hopefully helpful. That's at least the goal. My chosen topic is Adventist and Creation, A Way Forward. And I'd like to set the stage for our discussion by sharing a personal experience from several years ago. A number of years ago, I was visiting a relative, and this relative introduced me to a physician friend of his who had a collection of fossils. One of these fossils that he had in his collection was a finger or toe bone. It's illustrated here. In one view, this is looking at it in another view, that resembles in a general way those of our fingers and toes. You can see he actually, this. I believe he was a radiologist and so had plenty of access to x-ray equipment, and he actually took a picture of his hand with this bone beside his hand, which is what you see up on the screen, and kindly actually allowed me to take that x-ray image with me. Now, this gentleman was quite convinced that he had found the finger bone of a giant human. And indeed, if this were a human, it would be a fairly good-sized individual, if you can see the comparison there of the finger bone of the fossil versus his own hand. He was not a small man. Now, I was immediately a bit skeptical, since to my knowledge, every other such claim that's been made over the last 100, 200 years or so has, if once searched out, turned out to be something else, perhaps a mammoth or mastodon bone or something like that. Well, this clearly isn't a mammoth or mastodon bone, but I know enough about mammals to know that basically all mammals have finger bones that look sort of like that, or at least most mammals do. Now, fortunately, he collected some other material, and one of the bones he collected is illustrated here on the screen. There's a penny there for scale, and that was in this collection, and as soon as I saw that, I knew, okay, I know what that is. This bone is absolutely unique. It is a specific construction of an ankle bone that's only found in even-toed ungulates, what we call artiodactyls. This is called the astragalus bone, and all mammals have the astragalus bone, but it has two sort of pulley-like surfaces on the astragalus, which is unlike any other group. Most mammals will have an astragalus that will look something like this. You have a pulley-like surface here, but on the other surface you have a more solid articular surface that doesn't rotate like this surface does, whereas this particular one, he actually let me have this, which was very, very kind of him, has a clear sort of pulley-like surface on both ends. As soon as I saw that, I knew that was an artiodactyl. Well, I shared with him my insights that I was pretty sure this wasn't a giant human. I thought it probably was some large artiodactyl. I didn't know exactly what, maybe a bison or something like that. And I don't think he was real happy with my interpretation. But he was a very gracious man, and as I mentioned, he allowed me to take this astragalus bone with me. And I've been using it in my teaching ever since. It's a great example that I can use when I illustrate the construction of an artiodactyl ankle. Now, I mentioned that this was only found in this particular group, the artiodactyls. Well, that was then. Subsequently, it's been found in one other group. Quite curiously, oh, this is just an illustration of a deer, which is in that family that has this kind of bone. Curiously, that group is whales. Now, some of you, if you're astute observers of nature, will realize that whales don't have hind legs. So if a whale doesn't have a hind leg, how could it have an astragalus? Well, modern whales don't have hind legs. But if you go back to the Eocene, where we have the earliest whales, they have hind legs. Here is a reconstruction of one of the earliest known whales. You might ask, why on earth does anybody call that a whale? Which is a fair question. But details of its construction of its skull has convinced scientists that it is in fact related to whales. Well, that doesn't look much like a whale. Why are the earliest whales in the record limbed? Interesting question. Now, in 2004, I think it was, two papers came out, one in Science, one in Nature, within about a week of each other, both describing fossil whales with well-preserved hind limbs. This is one that's on display at the Field Museum of Natural History, and if we zoom in on the ankle of this whale, sure enough, it has a double pulley astragalus. So now we know that two groups have this, the artiodactyls and the whales. Now this raises some interesting questions. Why? Most paleontologists would believe that this reflects a common ancestry. They both share this particular unique construction of the ankle because of a common ancestor. In any case, certainly from a creationist perspective, it's a little puzzling why the earliest whales are the only ones with hind limbs, and why actually as you go down the sequence, the limbs essentially become more and more terrestrial. Now, what's my point with this little story? My point is we have this one little bone. And this little bone essentially serves as a metaphor, I think, of our experience as we've sought to make sense of the world around us from a creationist point of view. On the one hand, we have our hopes. We would like to find, as we study nature, we would like to find an easy match where we can make it fit our understanding of the biblical view of prehistory. On the other hand, we have the reality of what we actually find. And sometimes what we actually find just doesn't match what we hoped to find. So we have our hopes and we have what we find. Now, I don't want to imply that every time there's a mismatch. That's not my point. My point, though, is that in a number of cases, this has happened. And it's led us to, it's an illustration of a rather long-standing tension that we've experienced in our community as we have seriously attempted to understand the Bible and understand nature. Now, this tension, I believe, has very obvious roots. Those roots can be seen on the buildings here on our very campus. We're serious about theology. So serious that I don't know how much the church spends each year supporting the seminary here on campus, but I'm sure it's millions and millions of dollars. Revised or a renovated theology building here at the seminary. And if we actually even look at the pane in the front window of the seminary, circled and boxed in yellow on this screen, we find that the doctrine of creation is very central to our thinking as Adventists, this sort of most paradigmatic of Adventist texts. Revelation 14 uses the language of creation. Worship him who made heaven, earth, the sea, and the fountains of waters. So clearly, we're serious about theology, and we're very serious about the doctrine of creation theologically. We're also serious about science. Science complex shown here on the screen. Here at Andrews, we have, in my judgment, perhaps the strongest science program within the denomination. An excellent science program. We're serious about science. And so, as a consequence, when the two disagree, we don't have an easy way out. We won't dismiss the Bible, and most of us also don't believe it wise to simply dismiss God's revelation in nature either. So here we are. And that's basically what I'll say about what I see as this history of attention. What I would like to do today is ask sort of this following question. Given this context, we take our theology seriously, we take our science seriously, and given the reality that at present we face some rather substantial tensions in our theological and scientific understanding, how can we leverage that in a positive way? Are there ways we can move forward such that we can actually leverage this tension, the conflict in our understanding, to do something positive, to make some progress? Does this give us an opportunity to grow? And that's sort of the basis of my remarks here that hopefully will be of some use to at least a few of you as we move along. I'm going to suggest that yes, it does provide such an opportunity. And I would like to briefly explore four ways in which I think the experience we have facing genuine tensions between our best theological and our best scientific understanding at present, the way we can leverage these to accomplish something good. Many of these will have to do with education because that's what I do. I'm a teacher. But I think they can apply in other ways as well. They're up on the screen. I don't need to read them point by point, but this just gives a brief outline of what I would like to do for a few minutes. So let's begin by, I guess I should look and make sure, okay, make sure that what's on the screen is what's here, because that would be bad otherwise. So, let's get started and begin with this first point. Motivate creative scholarship and discovery. Now, I don't know about you, but in my experience, oftentimes the seed of an intellectual journey is something that just doesn't fit. Something doesn't quite work right. I don't know how to put it together. Tension often provides both the motivation and the material for intellectual endeavor. We study what we don't understand so that we can understand it, and it gives us motivation so that we can understand it. I doubt there are very many of you who are scientists or other scholars who don't find some motivation by a genuine puzzle that you haven't yet figured out. I really like this quote on screen here from a genuine Renaissance man of the 20th century, a scientist, an astrophysicist, actually, by the name of Thomas Gold. You can see the quote up here. Is he says, "There is nothing more interesting or more important in science than the observations we cannot explain." And he goes on to suggest that the reason for that is that it's those observations that give us the opportunity to unburden ourselves from false beliefs. They give us the excuse to discover. Now, as I mentioned, Gold was an astrophysicist. But if we take a look at some of the areas that he himself made contributions in, you can see this guy was a bit of a Renaissance man. His ideas about the origin of the universe have kind of gone by the wayside. He was one of the proponents of the steady state theory of the origin of the universe. But he actually did fundamental research in the question of how the ear discriminates pitch. This is an astrophysicist. He made fundamental theoretical insights into the nature of pulsars. And he has rather controversial ideas about how petroleum originates. So this guy's all over the map. But for him, this quote sort of is a guiding star. Nothing more interesting or more important than the observations we cannot explain. That, I think, gives at least a context for why this also, in our own context, provides an opportunity for continued scholarship and research. Now, I'm very pleased that historically, Seventh-day Adventists have engaged this, I believe, quite admirably. Adventists, and I'm proud of this, have made serious contributions to a number of areas of science, particularly in geology, paleontology, related areas, that was motivated either directly or indirectly by this underlying tension between an understanding of the biblical narrative of creation and an understanding of the scientific narrative of creation. Now, most of this work has centered around the question of time, because unless you have been in a desert cave, you will realize that for most Seventh-day Adventists, that's a fundamental question, how to put together biblical sort of notions of creation's chronology and typical scientific notions of creation's chronology. So there's been an awful lot of effort to try to account for geological phenomena within a much shorter period of time. And of course, this leads to the other side of this emphasis, and that is on catastrophe, with the sort of paradigm of catastrophes in Adventist thought relating to these things being the flood in the time of Noah. Now, whatever you think about the particular models that have been used to generate this research, it is simply a fact that some very interesting work has been accomplished growing out of this tension. I have here some examples, and work with the Yellowstone fossil forests, work with ancient lakes in the Green River Formation of Wyoming, trackways, fossil turtles, fossil whales, some fossil eggshell work. Jim has certainly been one of the leaders in the work on fossil eggshells. Now, I don't want to go over these in great detail. Here on the screen, on the very top right, I have a picture of a colleague of mine standing beside one of these fossil trees in Yellowstone. Certainly the Ritlands will be very familiar with the with these fascinating trees there in Yellowstone. On the bottom, we have a former student. No, this is actually a student who's alive, but he's sitting here, he's laying here. Each of these piles of bones through here represents a disarticulated fossil turtle. It was a study I was involved in, looking at what kinds of processes were involved in this very large-scale fossil deposit. But rather than go into all of these in great detail, I'll just simply take one example to illustrate how working within a different frame of reference, asking different questions, motivated ultimately by this tension, has resulted in some fascinating research. The one I'll just briefly comment on is a work done by my colleague, Leonard Brand, on fossil whales. Now, Art kindly put up a picture of me with a fossil whale that you saw earlier. I should tell you, I did participate in that project for about 3 weeks. It was a very interesting project. This is down from the west coast of Peru. Whoa. And these deposits are ancient marine deposits that have been uplifted since they were formed, obviously. They're now on land. And they include some exquisite fossils. Lest I take too much credit for this research, I should indicate that my primary contribution was to help do some field work for 3 weeks, and then 2 days before I was to leave, to get my field book, GPS unit, which was Leonard's, video camera and digital camera stolen. So that essentially all the data I collected ended up in some thief's warehouse. It turned out that the thief, we're quite sure, was our driver, but that's another story. Now, what I want to touch on with this project is that Leonard and others, some of his students, keyed in on this when they were visiting Peru a number of years ago. They noticed these fossil whales, and initially they were asking the question, why are they so well preserved? Scientists have been studying these whales for decades, but almost all of the research had been done on questions such as taxonomy. What kinds of whales are there? Questions about evolution. What sorts of changes are present in the sequence of fossil whales? But no one had really asked the question, why are these whales there and so well preserved? Now, for Brand, working from a creationist point of view, that was an obvious question because coming from an expectation of rapid burial, this looked like an interesting problem to be pursued. He did pursue this problem and has ended up with some fascinating research publications. Let me just show you one more slide here on this. A few facts about these whale fossils. The first is that some of them are just phenomenally preserved. You've already seen that in this one. Look at that whale. This whale, by the way, is upside down. This is the palate of the mouth, so the skull is sort of back like this. This is the lower jaw here. Here's one of the flippers. This flipper's eroded away. And here we have the vertebral column. You don't get that kind of preservation very commonly in the fossil record. This preservation is so phenomenal that in some cases, these whales are filter feeding whales. In some cases, you can actually see the baleen still in place. Now, for those of you who don't know what baleen is, these filter feeding whales have this fingernail-like material that hangs down in plates from the upper jaw, forms a basket around the sides of the jaw, and they swim through the water and filter out krill and whatever from the water, and that's how they eat. This material is not bone. It's formed of, as I mentioned, fingernail-like material. Right here, these lines here represent where baleen was present. Obviously, some very unusual circumstance to get this. So that's the first fact, very well preserved. The second fact is that they're often buried in sediments that are composed primarily of little microscopic organisms called diatoms. Now, usually in modern environments, these are thought to accumulate on the order of perhaps a few centimeters per thousand years. But anyone thinking about this very long will realize that a whale carcass is not going to lay on the bottom of the ocean for thousands of years, getting buried at that kind of rate and not decompose. Something is not computing here. That's not going to work in this case. The third point to notice here is that we're not talking about one single event, one mass mortality of one horizon. We have these whales all through a sequence. These are meters here, so in this particular section, we have whales through what, maybe a 7,500-meter sequence. Now, the point of this, by the way, is not to prove that this proves Noah's flood. Brand himself doesn't think that these represent flood deposits. He thinks they're later. But what it shows, I believe, is how coming from a different point of view, motivated by this puzzle that we have, this underlying puzzle of how do we deal with science and the Bible together, some very, very interesting and fascinating research has been done. In this particular case, it looks to me like these whales accumulated pretty fast. Interestingly enough, Brand had this published in the journal Geology. Now, the journal Geology is something like the journal Science, only it's specific to geology. So this is a prominent journal. By the way, another one of their articles from one of his students, Brand is also co-author on, just came out about a week ago in the journal, we call it Paleo Cube. What's it? Paleogeography, Paleoecology, Paleoclimatology, I think, something like that. And another very, very interesting study. All right. So, what is my point here? I don't want to get off the track. My point initially, again, given the fact that we face very real tension, one of the things we can do is leverage that to continue to foster creative, good, solid, scientific, and I would argue theological scholarship. Now, I need to be fair, however. The fact that we have been doing this work well, I believe, doesn't mean that things always work out quite so nicely. Research has a way of sometimes taking you where you didn't intend to go. Sometimes it leads you into awkward places. In paleontology, that can be quite literally. We were on a dirt track trying to get to a site somewhere off. I don't remember just where that site was. Leonard, with his explorer, comes running through the gully up over the other side and, of course, didn't realize that since the last time he'd been on the road, a rainstorm had created another gully, and there we were. I was sitting in the front passenger seat of this car when this happened, and it was interesting, kind of up like this. We got out, obviously, all of us big men managed to hang on to the back left corner of this car and get the wheels back on the ground so we could get out of there. But I'm using this purely as an analogy, of course. The analogy is that research sometimes takes you where you didn't intend to go. There would be many, many examples that could be given. But certainly, as we have done this work, we have found a number of cases where things don't fit quite so easily into the models that we would like to have them fit into. And I don't want to spend too much time here, but just a couple of brief examples. Context would be that Adventists have typically worked within this model, that much of the fossil record was laid down rapidly in the events associated with the flood, but Adventist research, done, I think, very credibly, carefully, and well, has suggested that at multiple places in the fossil record, we simply have some time represented. We don't have this in the order of minutes to hours, as you would expect, perhaps, in a flood model. Paul Buchheim's work in the Green River Formation, certainly, well, he, I believe, makes a case that some of these deposits are more rapid than often thought. They certainly aren't happening in minutes or hours or months. They represent some periods of time, probably years, decades, centuries. So again, here we are. We've been doing this work for many, many years, and I believe we need to continue doing that. This is a creative way to move forward in truth-seeking as we face tensions. However, my honest assessment of where we are at present is that while we have accomplished some really cool things, we've learned some neat stuff about the world, we've sometimes solved some problems, that overall, we have not fundamentally made much progress in solving the basic tensions that Adventist theology has with our scientific understanding. It hasn't got there yet. All right, I hope we'll continue. This leads to my second point, and make sure I don't take too long here. You guys are going to all zone out, but well, we'll try to keep things moving. There's one thing I know absolutely for sure. Well, probably a few things I think I know absolutely for sure. But one thing in this case I know for sure. That is, we don't have it figured out. I know that. We don't have it yet figured out. When our understanding of two sources of truth disagrees substantially, we know that our understanding of truth in some way isn't yet complete. At least seems to me that way. There's more work to do. In that context, I'd like us to ask, what kind of people do we need in the Adventist community to make progress towards truth? What kind of thinkers do we need if we know for sure that we aren't yet there? I'm going to suggest a model that I find helpful. Our quest for truth is a communal quest for truth. We as a community are seeking a better understanding of God and His Word and His world. So that's the up arrow. We're seeking for truth. Along the way, I would argue that we have sort of two kind of forces maybe pulling us. We have one that pulls us towards stability, holding on to what we already know, not changing. That would be what the conservatives, in a sense, do for us. The conservatives help us preserve what we've already gained. On the other hand, we have forces that, if left entirely on their own, might almost tend towards a bit of an anarchist point of view. We have the mavericks who keep pushing the boundaries, keep making things uncomfortable, trying out new ideas, trying to solve problems that others haven't solved. Now, commonly, these two groups don't particularly like each other very much, it seems to me. However, my argument here is that if we are going to continue seeking truth, given the tensions we face, we genuinely, truly need both kinds of thinkers. I'm not talking about tolerate. I'm talking about truly need. This isn't an idea I invented. One form of this I got from David Raup. David Raup is an evolutionary paleontologist retired from the University of Chicago. I just found out the other day that Raup has retired to a tiny island up in the northern part of Lake Michigan. Well, that's interesting. Raup was once president of the Paleontological Society. He was one of these grand theoretical thinkers in geology and paleontology. Came up with some all sorts of interesting ideas. One of the ideas he was involved in was the Nemesis Star. Have any of you heard of the Nemesis Affair? It was this notion that there was a companion star to the Earth that periodically would go through the Oort cloud and spin off comets, where the comets would come and hit the Earth and cause mass extinctions periodically about every 26 million years. Anyway, that was Raup's idea. So Raup was a bit of a speculator in some sense. But Raup makes some interesting points about the nature of science. He says, given a choice, the scientific community invariably sticks with the conventional wisdom. Science as a community, in general, is a conservative endeavor. Scientists are often wary of new ideas. You might ask, why? You think of science as sort of, everybody just searches for truth, no holds barred. The scientists tend to hold what they already think works. They're resistant to something new. And Raup sees that as a genuine contribution. If you didn't have them, well, and everybody was going off on their own way, science simply wouldn't get anywhere. However, he suggests that stagnancy in science is avoided because of the mavericks in every generation, people who keep challenging convention and thinking up new ideas. And he goes on to say, for the sheer blank of it, and I won't fill in the blank. But it's this balance that keeps science moving. The conservatives keep science from simply fracturing into a bunch of nuts going off after everything. Most mavericks are nuts, okay? Most maverick ideas aren't worth the time of day. But on the other hand, if all you have is the conservatives, you won't get anywhere in this view. You need both, according to this model. And I would ask, does this hold for our church? I think the answer is yes. I don't know how to operationalize that in a church setting. But it seems to me, we know we haven't got there yet at truth, completely, complete truth. And I believe that as this is true in science, this gives us an opportunity to model and actually seek to accomplish this vision of truth-seeking with both of these thought styles needed. Now, I'm a teacher, and I'd like to put this in the context of teaching, and I've come up with my rule of thumb, which is I probably cross out the good ones. I'm sure someone else has thought of this before, but at least I thought of it. And I think there's some practical implications here. This is really a pastoral call as a teacher. But my rule of thumb is try to avoid "you can't" statements in interaction with students. Let me give a couple of examples. You can't be honest with the data and believe that life was created a few thousand years ago. Okay? That's a kind of statement that perhaps some of the people on one side of our continuum might argue. On the other hand, I'd want to be very careful with a statement that you can't be faithful to the Bible and accept long age creation. I want to be careful about "you can't" statements. Now, I would want students to think very carefully about their positions, whatever their positions are. They would understand the implications of their positions. But I'm very cautious about "you can't" statements. And the reason for that is, given that I want to have the conservatives retained and maintained and supported within my church community, and I want the Mavericks also retained within my church community, I'm going to have to leave room for both of them to do some exploring. The danger, I think, is that students might take me seriously and opt out of Christian faith if I put things in quite such terms. So that's perhaps a practical application of this principle. The tension gives us the opportunity to affirm, truly affirm, I think, different thought styles in the search for truth. All right. I am running a little late, so let me just move through this one fairly quickly. Most of us know that good thinking is hard work, all right? It's kind of hard work to think clearly, probably why I don't do it very often, but in any case, we try. Learning to do it well involves sustained practice, but frankly, it's hard to do this hard work when everybody agrees with you. If everything just falls into your lap, then why do the work? It's obvious. When you face tensions, there's a real opportunity, I think, to educate young people and educate ourselves to become better, more careful thinkers. And I really think that's an opportunity that we can leverage, particularly as Christian educators. Now, I have this notion here that I kind of like to use in teaching. I want my students to learn to fairly understand ideas. Believe we often move so quickly to evaluation that we don't spend long enough to know what it is we're evaluating. We want them to fairly understand ideas. We want them to be careful in evaluating honestly those ideas. I have a little matrix here that I find helpful, thinking of ideas in terms of data, theory, shaping principles. I'm not going to go there right now because we're running a little low on time. But I believe these are really important skills in the modern world. We face some phenomenally complex issues in the modern world. Consider the environmental issues of our world. If we face them simply in our very simplistic thinking styles, are we going to accomplish? Are we going to really address those issues effectively? We really need to help our students gain these skills in the modern world. Now, perhaps the best way to see these skills is to see what happens when they're not properly followed through, these skills and these attitudes towards thinking. And I'm going to give you a quote, and I want to be careful here, because what I'm going to actually choose is a quote from an evolutionary biologist that I believe illustrates rather poor thinking as a contrast. And I'm going to use it that way because I think for some of us it'll be at least easier to see that if we see it on the other side. This can happen just as well inside, okay? But as I mentioned, tensions give us this opportunity for good, careful, clear thinking. But unfortunately, if our interest is simply and primarily to be right, these tensions can also lead to rather unfortunate thinking styles. And this is what we don't want to encourage for our students. Here's a quote. This is a counterexample. And this is from a book by a guy named Donald Prothero. Or Prothero. Prothero is a prominent author in geology, paleontology. He's written numerous textbooks. I use one of his textbooks in a paleobiology class I've taught, a general paleobiology class that I've taught a couple of times. Prothero has recently written a book called Evolution, What the Fossils Say and Why It Matters. And on page 70 of this book, he's taking on the creationist models of how the Grand Canyon formed. And frankly, there are probably some challenges in creationist models and how the Grand Canyon formed. But what I want to illustrate here is how someone with a particular agenda, his agenda is very, very obvious here, someone with a particular agenda can do shallow thinking. He's talking about the Grand Canyon. He says, even stronger proof that the Grand Canyon wasn't formed by the flood is that many of the ancient dune surfaces are these deposits in what's called the Coconino Sandstone with these big, what look like ancient sand dune structures preserved in them, are covered with trackways of land reptiles. How does a creationist explain these dry sand dune features and dry land reptile trackways with a huge flood? I've read the creationists' attempts to explain these features, and they are classic examples of special pleading, twisting, and distorting scientific evidence as they thrash around with their completely unconvincing scenarios. Now, first of all, just the language of that is actually quite reminiscent of common creationist language. But the second thing I would point out here is I happen to know the creationist who has done some stellar research on the Coconino Sandstone trackways, Leonard Brand. His research has been published in Geology, again, peer-reviewed, excellent research, providing rather compelling evidence that the trackways that he's studying appear to have been formed underwater. Somehow, in the interest of making the point, that is simply missed by this author in his attempt to pin down his opponents. Now, my point here is not to be too hard on Prothero. He's a good guy, he's a bright guy. But it's to illustrate the kind of thinking we don't want to encourage for our students. And I fear that sometimes in our effort to be right, we may encourage that kind of thinking. We need to be careful with that. This is not just about skills of thinking. This is also about virtues of how we think. This is something I've been thinking about recently. We can help our students gain skills in teaching, in their thinking, but we also want them to acquire virtues, attributes of character in how they think. I've been helped by this, by a book by Jay Wood, a fascinating little book called Epistemology, Becoming Intellectually Virtuous. This is a picture I found of him on the web. He's a philosophy professor at Wheaton College. And I won't go into these in great detail. He looks at epistemology, how we know, from the point of view of becoming virtuous knowers. And I really like that idea. Can we use these tensions as an opportunity to help our students become virtuous knowers who are studious, honest, have appropriate intellectual humility? I think we have some room to grow there. I know I do, and I hope this is something we will think about. One of the points here that I particularly want to tie up here with is his last virtue. The virtue of wisdom. We don't talk a lot about wisdom today, do we? You know, we talk a lot about knowledge. We talk a lot about information. But wisdom, which he contrasts with folly. Now, Wood suggests that wisdom has more to do with what kind of persons we are than about the particular beliefs we hold. And he suggests that wise people are people who orient their intellectual skills and their lives, for that matter, towards what is ultimately meaningful. And I'd ask myself, we've been addressing the questions of creation for a long time. Important questions, to be sure. But perhaps appropriately, if we think of this question of wisdom and seeking what is ultimately most important, we could ask ourselves, out of this long-standing tension, are we concerned with what is most important? This leads to my last point, and I'll end on this. Try not to take too much longer. So, rethinking priorities towards a new creationism. Now, I know that the title New Creationism was a book title, wasn't it, back in, I don't know, a long time ago. It's not that new anymore, but that was a book title at some point in the past. And I want to return here to the context of our presentation. Suggested that we face a real tension between what we hope to find and what we sometimes actually find in our study. This is a frustrating tension, but potentially constructed, as I've tried to show. And I'm going to end here by arguing that perhaps one appropriate response to attention like this is to ask, again, are we asking the most important question? In the language of intellectual virtues, are we investing our capital in what is most meaningful? Now, our focus today is on creation, Adventists and creation. Now, we might contrast this with decreation, right? We've got creation, God's work of building up, and we have decreation. Now, maybe this will be a little controversial, and I don't want to be too controversial, but I want to just make a point here. Over the last 50 years or so, creationism has actually spent most of its time on decreation. Let me suggest. In our efforts to defend the literal historicity of the creation narrative, we've primarily done so by focusing on the great decreation of the story of the flood. We've actually done relatively little work motivated directly by the creation itself, other than preserving the historicity of that account. But we've used the flood account as an umbrella to help explain how we get this fossil sequence in a short period of time. And I don't want to denigrate that. That's been a model that's been fruitful in many ways. But could we look at creationism a little differently, a new creationism? And rather than simply defend an idea, which may be important, could we defend the creation itself from serious human causes of decreation? And there are many in the world today. How would wisdom guide us on this question? I don't want to propose a simple either-or solution. It's very likely we would want to do both. But are we investing our passion for creation into the actual intellectual and life work of taking care of the real creation itself? Let me give one illustration. Something I just learned about. I got a little brochure from the World Wildlife Fund WWF, that talked about the Coral Triangle. I didn't know about the Coral Triangle. That's not terminology I'm familiar with, but this is a screenshot from Google Earth, one of my absolutely favorite programs now. I don't know how Google manages to come up with these things, but to be able to zoom in on my house is just amazing in any case. But here, this is a screenshot from Google Earth, and I've traced out this coral triangle. Now, it's not an exact triangle, but sort of the basic area here is clear enough. This is a region in Southeast Asia with remarkable coral ecosystems. This triangle has 6 out of the 7 species of marine sea turtles preserved in the world, are present in this region. It has 3,000 species of reef fish just in this region alone. If I remember right, I don't state exactly correct. I believe this was 2 times the number in other typical reef systems. So this is a very rich system. 75% of all the world's known coral species are preserved in this triangle right here. Now, as I was preparing for this presentation, just yesterday I was in the library actually trying to get a little information on the Coral Triangle, had a little bit of data to talk about, and I found out, I don't know if any of you know this, did you know that this is the International Year of the Reef? Does anybody else know that? I didn't know that. Now, I have no idea who came up with this being the International Year of the Reef. I'm sure anybody could come up with a name and float it out there, but at least for somebody thought that this was the International Year of the Reef. Apparently, there was an earlier one in 1997. You might ask, who would go to the trouble of the International Year of the Reef? Well, it turns out that the journal Science thinks this might be interesting. December 14, 2007, the front cover has this written in bold on the front, Reefs in Trouble. Now, Reefs in Trouble, What's happening? Why would Reese be in trouble? Well, there are a number of factors. First of all, there are some important local factors. Deteriorating water quality, pollution, sediment runoff from local erosion on land with deforestation, all sorts of different things. We have destructive harvesting, where the fishermen may use dynamite to stun the fish so they can capture them. Of course, that doesn't do a whole lot of good for the reefs. The result of these kinds of local processes is that the current thought is that about 88% of Southeast Asian reefs are considered threatened. Now, to add insult to injury, the temperature is getting warmer. Of course, we have a lot of discussion about that, but I don't think there's much discussion about the fact that it's actually getting warmer. And studies have, documented fairly convincingly that as water temperatures go up, there's an increased frequency in what's known as coral bleaching, where the corals have within them little microscopic organisms, little algae, that actually capture light from the sun and give the corals food to eat. A huge percentage of the corals' food comes in this way. And when the temperature gets too high, for whatever reason, the corals get rid of their algae. This is not particularly good for the corals, and they aren't able to grow very well when that happens. To put matters worse, as carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere are going up, guess what? Carbon dioxide concentrations in the oceans are going up. That leads rather directly to increased acidity in the oceans, which leads rather directly to a decrease in skeletal growth of corals. The article in this paper, in this journal, suggested that corals are on a trajectory, potentially to a tipping point, where the reef ecosystems, major reef ecosystems of the world, would collapse to be replaced by algal-dominated and much, much less diverse ecosystems. Now, how in the world did I get onto that, on the topic of creation? Well, I'd like to ask you, do we care? Do we give a rip? What if Adventists were known as people who really cared about the doctrine of creation? Not just the doctrine, but the actual reality of creation itself. We have a geoscience research institute. I wonder what would happen if we had a creation preservation institute. What if new creationists were at the forefront of gaining knowledge about and working to conserve this amazing creation? All right. I would suggest this actually has some implications, perhaps, for how we think about our approach to these questions. It might have some implications for our theology. Our theology might spend some more time asking how the doctrine of creation teaches us about how to live in appropriate ways as stewards of creation. It might have impact on what we do in our science. We would certainly want to get the very best of science, what it teaches us about creation, both its history and its function, and how we can apply this knowledge to serve as effective stewards. I would suggest that this would even potentially have impact on disciplines like our focus on geology, our questions about time. For example, at present, we do spend a lot of our time thinking about time. We address this question, but why? We address it primarily from a philosophical point of view, seeking to find some resolution between biblical and scientific understanding of chronology. But it turns out that the question of time is actually quite directly relevant to questions of how we care about creation, because it turns out that we can potentially learn something fundamentally important about how creation has responded to previous crises if we can put that history into some sort of time sequence. So we actually have very good motivation to try to get it right about time, and not just for theological reasons. All right. I'm basically done. So as I conclude, I want to emphasize that while we've talked about tensions, and there are tensions, What a privilege it is to be an Adventist and a biologist, tasked with the joyful work of studying God's creation. It's really, really fun. It's not all about tension. Yes, the tensions are real, but the privilege and the joy of the journey far outweigh them. Besides, I think we can leverage these tensions to accomplish some worthy ends. Perhaps they can motivate our scholarship. They can give us opportunity to affirm the need for a diverse array of thought styles in seeking to move forward towards truth. They can encourage us to cultivate careful, virtuous Christian thinking. And I hope these tensions can stimulate us to ask some broader questions about how the doctrine of creation can influence how we think about the world around us and perhaps stimulate a new creationism. Not just the idea, which is important, but the creation itself. And with that, I'm done and open it up for questions. So,
questions?
I appreciate this. It's very, very thoughtful and always helpful. But it seems to me you're kind of shifting from epistemology to ethics, you call new creationism, and that is probably inappropriate in a way because I would think, according to orthodox Darwinism, the destruction of species is nothing but natural selection at work, and one shouldn't be distressed about it. I don't know how they would answer to that. The sudden creation of fossil whales, or whatever you want to say, I assume Leonard Brand is putting that forward as a proof of catastrophism. But I'd be much more persuaded if it was a burial of elephants than if it were a burial of whales. I don't quite see how that would happen in a flood. These are kind of different questions. But I
okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a philosopher, so neither am I an ethicist. I should probably not comment on either of those points of, you know, epistemology to ethics. Maybe I got things that kind of run together here a little bit. But I think it's appropriate for us to think about where the doctrine of creation takes us, and in terms of looking at the care of creation. While certainly the doctrine of creation, I believe, could provide the foundation for an ethical stance that would be difficult to ground on naturalistic principles. I think that's true. So I believe that's an important component. I think it'd be at least worth asking how taking a little different focus would shape our epistemological approaches, too. In other words, I don't know what I'm saying exactly, so maybe I should stop. But if we're really serious about engaging the creation as it actually is, then our epistemology needs to appropriately give us the room to follow the best tools we can to find it as it actually is. And so I think there might be some implications for how we think as well as how we live. I don't know if that makes any sense or not. Back to the other question, you know, it would be more persuaded for whales. That's fine. I mean, if there are elephants, that would certainly be interesting. It is true, however, that most whales today that die and fall to the seabed do not get preserved like that. These are extraordinary circumstances. Something unusual is happening there to bury whales, over, and it's not just a single horizon. It's over a fairly thick sequence of sedimentary deposits. So there's still something interesting going there, but yes, it is in a marine setting. No. Brand is pretty careful in his publication. He published this in Nature, just as a little bit of kind of background knowledge. He believes that this gives him suggestion that these things were buried in the order of weeks to a few months, not more than that. And I would agree with him based on what I know of whales. But he wanted to be not too confrontive, and so when he actually submitted his manuscripts, he put months to years in the manuscript. And one of his reviewers, who he thinks was probably Anna K. Behrensmeyer, who's one of the major persons who studies this kind of thing in the world, I mean, this is not a creationist, wrote back and in the comments indicated, crossed out, you know, months to years and put weeks to months, and so he was quite happy to move it back. So the community acknowledges that, you know, that something very rapid is happening there. But he actually proposed, they proposed a mechanism for how you could get very rapid diatom accumulation and some currents bringing stuff in from outside. So he actually offered a mechanism, not just a sort of, I hereby prove that this was Noah's flood. He offered a natural mechanism for how you might get this in this circumstances, and the community bought it. So I think Brand sees this as an example of how looking at it from a different point of view suggests that there's less time in the record than many think. But beyond that, I don't think it goes beyond that. Well, I mean, you could drown a whale if you caught it in a net and held it underwater. I mean, they're air breathing animals. Why they died is a good question, and I don't know that they have it that sorted out. You know, was it toxins, feeding on red tide toxins or something? I don't think they have that sorted out. So, yeah.
The environmentalist Aldo Leopold makes, I think, a good point when he argues that we need to develop what he calls a land ethic. Just as we have an ethic for how we treat human beings, we have to develop an ethic for how we treat the land. See the land as mm-hmm. as important. In terms of ethical treatment.
Brand is published well. The work related to Yellowstone, however, and the supporting work building up to it, has not really been published well. The chemical signatures that suggest, for example, eruption of all four volcanoes in that area, and the work that was done in Hawaii is unpublished. And I think that this is something that if we're going to say we have something, it does need to be carefully documented and published.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't talk too much about that because it isn't published yet. So.
Will Magnus whale differ from whales with legs only with respect to having or not having legs?
The Eocene whales, there are three primary groups of whales. There are two that are around today. The regular toothed whales, like which include the dolphins and so forth, and the filter feeding baleen whales, those go back, I think, to the Oligocene. The Eocene whales are, as far as I know, all members of another group of whales known as the Archaeocetes. They are toothed whales, but they do differ from modern whales in some other respects. Now, there is a sequence within the Archaeocetes themselves. The early Archaeocetes in the sequence are, you know, as that one showed that one picture, appear to be fairly terrestrial animals. Then you have a number that appear to be more amphibious. The latest Archaeocetes from the late Eocene are very much, they're obviously fully aquatic whales. Now, they have, interestingly enough, as far as I know, all Archaeocetes might have hind limbs, but one of the late Archaeocetes from the late Eocene, sorry, I'm throwing around terms, Eocene, it's part of the fossil record, so I'm just... Don't worry about that term. It's a chunk of time in the fossil record. From the late part of this interval is they have legs, but the whale itself might be 60 feet long, and the legs are about this long. So they obviously aren't using the legs for any kind of locomotion. What they use them for is whether they use them at all isn't clear. But you do have a sequence within the Archaeocetes as well. But you, back to your question, yes, these whales do differ from the modern whales in a number of number of dental aspects and other aspects as well.
In the ideal scenario, would you like to keep the mavericks and the conservatives in the same tent? And where would you allow them to draw lines in the sand?
Yeah. Yes, I don't know. If we're not in the same tent, we're not pulling the same direction, and then we've lost the whole business. You know, to me, that the benefit... You know, you can think in a scientific community. I mean, potentially the scientific community can draw a circle and say, okay, well, the mavericks, you're out, right? And some scientists will do that. But frankly, if the mavericks are onto something and they start explaining things that the conservatives couldn't figure out, at some point, the scientists are going to realize, okay, you know, we drew that boundary, but we shouldn't, and so we'll make the boundary bigger and take them back in. But I'm not a politician. I'm not a church administrator. And you know, my hat goes off to church administrators. That's got to be a pretty tough job to hold together a very, very diverse church community. Where do those lines get drawn? Clearly, you know, think about Andrews University, for example. I've actually asked this question in classes to students, and you get interesting perspectives. And people, you know, students have different views of where those lines should be drawn. Now, if I think about it, I have a daughter who's in academy. She's going to be in college next year, hopefully here at Andrews. She's going to come to Andrews, given the financial incentive. Anyway, I was going somewhere with that. Oh, where would I want those boundaries for my daughter? I guess I could answer that question, you know. I don't want a missionary atheist teaching my daughter, okay, at Andrews University. I want someone who can be supportive of the effort to take seriously the scriptures and take seriously the world around them. But hey, if there's some variety amongst the teachers in terms of how they actually put that together, I'm fine with that. In fact, I think I'd be happy with that, because it would probably make her grow a little more. So,
one of the Mavericks argued in Adventist Today that there is such a thing as Adventist evolution. In other words, you can be an Adventist and an evolutionist. Would you be comfortable with that at Andrews University?
I'm not sure if I want to touch that one. I've said we need to be honest and have enough humility to be honest. I would certainly hope that everybody at Andrews University would be a creationist. Okay? And I would hope that all the biology faculty would be creationists. How did God do the creation? How long did he do the creation? Those are questions that I think there'll be some variation about. And so my fundamental point would be, is everybody at Andrews University a creationist? And I would accept that there probably is going to be some variety in how we understand that process. So philosophically, I would say I'm a creationist. And then we need to engage the data from the Bible and from nature to try to understand the process of how and when and how much time and so forth. I don't know if that answers your question, but that would be. At one sense, no, never mind, I won't say that. Okay, that's my answer, so yeah. Good.
Let me push it just one step further.
All right.
Could you accept a creationist who needed millions of years for the creation?
You know, I'm not going to answer that from the perspective of Andrews University, I hope that as we search for truth, we'll be open to search for truth, that we will be serious about listening to the scriptures to guide us as we move forward, that we'll be serious about listening to the nature as we go forward. And I'm not going to try to draw precise boundaries about who's in and who's out. If we're not listening to the scriptures, and if we're not listening to nature, if I'm going to be a scientist, I have to listen to nature. If I'm going to be a Christian, I have to listen to the scriptures. And I don't have a formula for how to make that, how to impose that template on everybody else. Sorry, I'm being evasive, I guess, but I can't answer any better than that, I don't think.
I thought the Mavericks were called unemployed.
I want us to comment on that. I mean, okay.
That's true.
But actually, I want to say something.
retired. Unemployed or retired.
I don't know for sure where I would categorize myself. Probably a little, you know, probably all the creative people like to think they're mavericks, you know, but I'm actually probably pretty conservative in many ways. But you know, I'll have to say that Andrews University has been a wonderful place to work. I've been blessed to work at Andrews University. This is a place. Yes, there's some tensions. Yes, there's some who would want to draw the lines real rigidly. But overall, Andrews has been a wonderful place to work, where good, solid Christian teachers who are good, solid scientists are working together to address these issues with some variety of viewpoints. But all of us, I think, with a heart to be supportive of our church in this effort, and with an attempt to be honest. And so I would say actually that I've been blessed to work at Andrews University, and I think it's been an environment that's really been a very positive one overall. That would be my kind of take on it.
Yeah, what you're speaking to is basically that all of us have certain frames in our mind, or concepts, or worldviews, and when a person with one set of concepts speaks to another group with a different set of concepts, then we see the tension arise. The question about could you be this and be an evolutionist? First of all, you've got to define what an evolutionist really is, just like you have to define what a creationist really is. And I may have a different set of mental frames to which I look to define creationism and to define evolutionism, or what the evolutionary theory is. And the evolutionary theory does not have any morality or ethic built into it. This is purely a description of what you see, or the data, with the imposition of a theory upon it. You and I are human beings, and we do have to make ethical decisions. If I interpret the world through the wrong frame of reference, and impose this or teach this to somebody else, and that results in their harm, then I have to ask myself, have I been ethical in the way I have presented this material? Have I balanced looking out for the community over looking out for the rights of the individual, etc.? So the ethical idea of natural selection, that doesn't appear in the records. But that teaching natural selection within certain frames of reference, that I see it works here, but not here. The material is left out. We have to admit that's mysterious, it's uncontrollable, etc. But the ethical theory comes out of what I do with material that I see through my frames of references or through my concepts. Mm-hmm. So there are people in the church, there are people on this campus who will never, ever see anything the same way I do, or you do, or whoever, as long as they can't see through any other frames of what are in their mind. And those things are pretty solid. They're almost physical. To ask a person the question about whether you could work at Andrews University and be an evolutionist, if I define evolution a certain way, the answer is certainly yes. And the same way as creationist. But first of all, you've got to set up boundaries or parameters of creationism and evolution that accept this interchange and this dialogue. In other words, we aren't going to talk.
Yeah, that's good points. You know, I would just as a comment, I actually think that, well, sometimes our focus on creation and these issues has been sort of in an apologetic mode. In fact, sometimes, very often, really the focus is sort of we're doing it an apology for. There's I think rich opportunity to think about the doctrine of creation, just move away from apology as a primary mode and move more towards the richness of the doctrine for shaping who we are and what we think about. I'm impressed, for example, with some of the reading I've been doing lately, that one can make a case that the doctrine of creation really resides at the base of, historically, of the rise of modern science, for example. And now, I'm not a historian, so I don't want to push that too far, but that it certainly might play a role in the sort of the culture in which modern science arises. And those are interesting questions that it might shape who I am in very, very fundamental ways. And I think maybe in the interest of sort of simple apologies, we sometimes forget those really deep ways where it can shape who we are and how we live and how we think. So from my point of view, that's just a wonderful place to begin as a sort of a framework for thinking.
Why would you mention liberationism? And you are referring to the fact that many people who support creation have spent a lot of time talking about decreation rather than being involved into defending creation itself. So are you referring to the fact that the church is not so involved in the debate about creation? Or were you more thinking about action that the church could be taking to impact in terms of preserving the environment? And if so, what kind of action would you see the church involved in that would effectively impact on a global scale preservation of the environment?
Yeah, you know, I'm one simple academic sort of asking some questions here and suggesting that maybe we could let the doctrine of creation shape our lives in ways that go beyond debate to ways that influence some of these broader questions. And I would say that both participating at the level of discussion and the level of action would be helpful steps. What those would be, wouldn't it be cool if the General Conference office was the most environmentally friendly office in Washington? I don't, you know, that's just a shot off the top of my head, you know, but and clearly we need to think about our mission, and so I'm not asking that we lose sight of our mission, but our mission is really a very holistic mission. You know, we think of health, we think of humans very holistically. We don't think of souls and bodies. We think of totalities. And frankly, my mind is going to be influenced not just by whether I have a disease, it's going to be influenced by this totality of the creation around me. And so I think the potential is there to do this and to be involved in ways that are very mission appropriate. I don't have real specific suggestions. That's just kind of off the top of my head, you know. Yeah.
I think that I'm so pleased to hear what you're saying, because I think there is at least the beginning of a growing awareness, even in theological circles in our church, of the importance of that we should be more involved with what you call new creationism, of caring for creation. We have several students who are actually writing dissertations on this subject, and I think that it's good to be aware of this. It's also, many people are not aware that although the General Conference may not actively be doing much, at least they have issued some statements.
Yes. Yes.
Which you can find on the General Conference mm-hmm. website that deal with the question
yeah.
of
yeah.
caring for the environment.
Yeah. Some of them pretty thoughtful ones, too.
Pardon?
And some thoughtful ones.
That's right.
Yeah.
And on the practical side, I mean, you cannot change the world. Only the Lord can make a new creation in the real sense. But, for instance, in Kenya and in Ghana, members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church are heavily involved in programs of reforestation to try to push back the desert.
Neat.
So there are things
yeah.
going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Much more.
Yeah. The one comment I won't. Then we'll catch. The one thing I want to just comment on that. And Peter, you've given me an excuse to say this. It won't come as news to any of us that this discussion has generated a fair bit of division in our community over the years. I know that personally, and you know, you sit around campfires in the field and you hear the chit chat and. Sometimes I just wish that chit-chat wouldn't happen, because we see things in sides and sort of shoot at each other. And I think this issue has the potential to be common cause for the conservatives and the mavericks. So, I mean, in that sense, I think it has potential to do something pastorally helpful as well as practically helpful. So, yeah, I agree with you, Peter, and I appreciate your comments on that.
Gordon.
I was going to point out an obvious linkage between our doctrine and the Sabbath being linked to
absolutely.
Creation. You didn't mention it, but I know it's probably on your mind.
Yeah. There are very rich links, actually, I think, within Adventism, too. Yeah. So Joanne Davidson has done some really neat stuff on that. So yeah.
Yes, Tom, I was just wondering, between the Maverick and consequence, you gave this model with the three of the metal, so then how to see if you could have from a difference about this called the quest for truth. How did you foresee for both sides to be able to come to talk to, reflect, to pray about, so that they can come to an agreement to a truth eventually, working toward that goal in a way, in having which sources could be parallel or similar to come to a more pluralistic truth, if we want to call it this way, and both sides.
Hmm. So what kind of venue? What kind of?
Yeah, how, because too often we come, as our brother mentioned, with different frames of work.
Mm-hmm.
How do we come? Because we come with our glasses, so to speak, but how do we come together at both sides with those frames, but being able to say, okay, as you mentioned, to be humble and so on, and to analyze and say, okay, let's try to work to become closer and to see and foresee the truth together, but the sources that we use to come to that.
You know, that's a good question. I believe that most thoughtful Adventists would agree that we take the scripture seriously. I mean, if we don't do that, we probably don't belong as an Adventist. But I don't know very many Adventists who really would say, ah, just throw out the science. Okay? Now, in practice, some might do that. But in principle, we're not really comfortable with that, I don't think, because we do have this sort of two-book idea of God's revelation. You know, what's the venue? I don't know. Maybe some more discussions like this where we can talk. I don't know. I really don't know. I think we have an awful lot more in common than we think. You know, I mean, I'm involved in a profession where there are people like Richard Dawkins. You know, Richard Dawkins and I don't have a whole lot in common. But I have a whole lot in common with basically every other Seventh-day Adventist in the world in that contrast. Now, actually, Richard Dawkins and I would have a few things in common, but not a whole lot. So I think that with a little work, we could find there's probably more common ground than we realize, and maybe that would give us a place to start. That doesn't really push your answer, push the answer forward real well, but at least that might be a place to start. So.
Can I just share a thought further on that? I find too often that we have these types of seminars or whatever, but it's only like kind of one person talking and not answering stuff. But how can we sit around being able to? And I guess I'm just asking, you don't have to answer.
Yeah. No, good questions. We have had, for example, on campus in the past, we had a reading group that dealt with these kinds of issues. We actually have a reading group on campus right now that's dealing with sort of environmental issues, where we invite people from a whole variety of points of view to come together and read and discuss and talk. Those are sort of informal for doing that. Maybe there are some more formal things that could be done to move that forward as well. You know, I don't know. We do have to be careful. We sometimes burn some bridges. And to be perfectly honest, you know, we had the series of discussions, the creation sort of discussions a few years ago that GC sponsored. And I think the first two of those were very, very productive, very, very, in terms of bringing people together to talk. And some things that happened at the third one kind of made some of us feel like, well, maybe it's time to not talk anymore. And so we kind of have to be careful about burning bridges in the way to keep that dialogue going. But I think we can move past that and hopefully.
Sometimes it seems like we are creating paper tigers, whereas if this doesn't come to pass, everything falls apart when they really aren't real. And isn't there perhaps a way to approach helping young people through understanding epistemology and philosophy, recognize how to better cope with ambiguity and faith? Because maybe we aren't going to find the answers we're looking for, yet, does that mean we throw out faith?
You know, we certainly need to help young people deal with ambiguity. We probably should start by modeling that. If we can deal with ambiguity, I think our students often... I find that our students are pretty resilient if they see that we can deal with ambiguity. So I think that's an appropriate place. That's an appropriate a goal, appropriate vision to guide us. I do think we need to be a little bit careful with it. I would say this cautiously, but I think that sometimes we can use that as a lazy way out of really dealing with what it looks like where things are going. And so we have to be careful with using ambiguity as sort of a cop-out for having the courage to say, okay, here's where I think things are going. And yeah.
Let's go ahead.
Discussion reminds me of how glad I was in the 25 years that I taught at Andrews that I was in the nursing department and not in the theology or biology. I could use science to help my patients, tell them that God loved them, forgave them, had meaning for their lives, and be there. But on the other hand, maybe I'm just practical, but I'd like to say might be too concise. But it seems I would be concerned if the theologians and the Adventist scientists did come to an agreement of what is truth, Because God is forever. I am the same to yesterday, today, and to tomorrow. And when we're learning about God, we're talking about the eternal truth. Science has changed in my short lifetime. You cited Dr. Gold, a physicist, earlier, and you listed several of his theories, and you said many of them are superseded by now. If the theologians and the creationists try and match the Bible to science in 10 years or 10 months or 10 minutes, science will have moved on in its understanding of the facts of today and come to a different theory. So why should we try it? Oh yes, of course, the academics and the scholars perhaps should talk, but how much effort should we make in wanting there to be agreement in something that changes using its knowledge and observations and facts of today with something that deals with something more eternal?
So that's a fair question. I'd make a couple of comments on it. The first comment I would say is that science isn't alone in changing. Theological understanding changes, you know. Biblical understanding changes as well. So humans change, and I think in that context we that would apply to both. Now maybe one could argue that, you know, the text is a text, and probably no one's going to find something phenomenally different. The text is there, you know, whereas we're always discovering something new in science. So maybe in that sense there's a little difference. I also think that we have to be a little careful that we don't oversell the changeability of science as well. Science does change, absolutely, and you're correct. I mean, our theories today, one thing we know for sure is that most of them, that at least many of them are at least incomplete, and some of them are wrong, we just don't know which ones. But there's also a certain sense in which, along the way, science is gaining knowledge that's probably giving us, we have this sense at least that we're at least getting a little closer to some sort of understanding of reality that seems to be a better understanding than what they had 100 years ago. So I would doubt if 100 years from now we would find, for example, that DNA had nothing to do with heredity. Now, it's theoretically possible, but I really would doubt that. I think we've learned something that's probably going to be here for a while. Now, some of the things we've learned aren't going to be that stable. So I think we have to keep that in mind, that we are learning some things that are likely to be a bit, just based on sort of our history, that are likely to kind of hang around for a bit. So I think we need to be careful about overselling the changeability of science, although we do need to humbly recognize the fact that humans do change in our thinking, and probably in science, maybe a bit more in theology, but there's also, you know, change in our understanding biblically as well. The point about being careful about, tying, for example, our theological understanding too tightly to a particular scientific model. Absolutely. We need to be really careful about that. I would agree with that. So.
Okay, let's stop there and see if we can make it home before we get snowed in. Let's thank Professor Goodman.